With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, Natalie Haynes returns to Little Atoms to talk about her latest novel, The Children of Jocasta. Natalie Haynes is a writer and broadcaster. She is the author of The Amber Fury, which was shortlisted for the Scottish Crime Book of the Year Award, and a non-fiction book about ancient history, The Ancient Guide to Modern Life, both of which we've talked about on Little Atoms previously. She has written and presented two series of the BBC Radio 4 show, Natalie Haynes Stands Up for the Classics. In 2015, she was awarded the Classical Association Prize for her work in bringing classics to a wider audience. And Natalie's latest book, The Children of Jocasta, we're going to be talking about today. Natalie, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Thanks for having me back in your fancy new studio.
Indeed.
It's lovely.
The Children of Jocasta is, I mean, to cut a long story short, it's a retelling of the Oedipus myth.
Yes.
But different.
Yes. Sarah Churchwell, who I know is a good friend to Little Atoms, I think coined, but she may just have read it somewhere, but I'm going to say she coined because it's so brilliant. It must be her. The phrase counter-mythical for it. So as a sort of parallel to counterfactual history, a counter-mythical telling of the Oedipus story. Yeah.
So why did you want to retell it? Why did you want to do the counter-mythical?
Well, I suppose in the first instance, I wanted to tell it because I think it is a genuinely great story, fully separately from being a, you know, seminal myth in a kind of history of ourselves. It's not an accident that Freud, you know, was drawn to it. It's full of archetypes which are integral to how we define ourselves and how we think, it seems to me. And you get sort of variations of this story told throughout the ages. So there's that. But it felt to me like it was particularly ripe for a retelling because if you go through the most famous version is obviously the Sophocles version, Oedipus the King, Oedipus Tyrannus in Greek, bafflingly by people called Oedipus Rex, although it isn't Latin and he's not a dinosaur, I've never understood it. But in that version, Jocasta has 120 lines, and that's not even 10% of the whole. You know, the central figure, of course, in that version is Oedipus. Although it's not, of course, I suppose, the central figure in Antigone, you'd think would therefore be Antigone, and she isn't in terms of line count, it's her uncle Creon. But Jocasta doesn't have very much to say in that, and Greek tragedy, and I adore it in almost all its forms, as you know, has no subtext. It's one of the things about it. We're going to have to wait till, like, Chekhov to get subtext. In Greek tragedy, nobody, you know, wishes they could go to Moscow and then goes off stage and shoots themselves in the head. They just come on stage and go, I'm furious, here is why. And so, actually, writing a novel around a tragedy or taking a tragedy to, for want of a less revolting verb, novelise it, is a really tempting thing to do because none of these characters has an inner life that we ever see on stage. You know, we get their big monologues and that's the closest we get to their thought process, but it's performed, you know, both performed and performative, I suppose. So it felt too tempting to fill in the gaps of who this woman was, who ends up, I mean, it's quite an extraordinary story that we mainly get it from Oedipus's perspective in the surviving versions of the story that we have. It just seemed to me, you know, too ripe to take it.
Well, you mentioned the idea of Chekhov and subtext and having to wait centuries and centuries and millennia, really, until that sort of thing comes along. And there are other ways in which this is a modernisation of the story. And by that, I don't mean this is, you know, like they do with Shakespeare, Oedipus set
it's
in
not
space
a modern
or
dress.
Something.
Yeah. Dad would have been so happy if I'd said it in space.
There are, that's next. That's,
my
that's
brother would have read it if I'd set it in space.
So there's two parallel stories here. The story of Jocasta and the story of her daughter, Ismene.
Yes.
And that story is told in the first person, which is obviously something that didn't exist when people were telling these myths.
Yeah, I suppose so. But I mean, and there are moments in the Odyssey, for example, which is by far more complicated in terms of its structure than the Iliad, although the Iliad is my favourite. The Odyssey is by far the more complex in terms of leaping through time, you know, the flashback sections and things like that. And then you'll get quite long sections where Odysseus will explain to, you know, Alcinous or, yeah, how he got to here. So in a way, I suppose that's a sort of an early version of a first-person narrative. Obviously, again, it's performed because Homer is singing rather than writing, and all of those things, all those caveats in place. And sorry to use a Latin word about a Greek thing. I shoot self in the head. But allowing for that, I didn't feel like that was too anachronistic overall, I think.
And so the other obvious difference, which you've already hinted at, is that this is the book. It's called The Children of Jocasta. This is the story of Oedipus, but told from the perspective of women who, in the original versions, and we'll come back to the word versions a bit later on in the interview.
And the word original.
Perhaps we should, yes. So why tell it from the women's perspective?
Just because it had been so overlooked, and that's not at all. I mean, I believe that all myth, when you tell it, it belongs both in the time in which it's set and in the time in which it's told. And I think that's always true. So I guess when you say original version of Oedipus, you probably mean Sophocles. But of course, he's not the original version. The earliest version that we have, I think, is the Odyssey. I think it's book 11, where Odysseus goes to the underworld, and it's just 10 lines. So it's incredibly slight. But therefore, what we would tend to see is, you know, the sort of the official version of this story is a retelling. And you can tell because the Sophoclean version is full of obsession about fatherhood and whether you can be certain that a child is your own. That belongs very much in the 5th century when it's being written, rather than perhaps in the mythic time in which it's set. So when you or I go to see a contemporary production, say the Ralph Fiennes version at the National Theatre a few years ago, we're watching a 21st century English translation of a 5th century BCE Greek translation of a much earlier Greek story. And so we watch a translator then spin this story into a 21st century version. But even if I went to see it in Greek now, I've seen Antigone in Greek, I don't think I've ever seen the OT in Greek, but if you were to go and see it in Greek, it would still be a translation of an earlier story. And so in Homer's version, Jocasta doesn't even have that name. She's called Epicast. The integral part, or an integral part of their story, that mother and son marry unknowingly, and then it becomes clear that that has happened, is still there. But although she has, as she does in the Sophoclean version, although she has committed suicide, Oedipus has not. One of the most famous things about him, he's not blinded himself in Homer's version. That's not there at all. He's still ruling Thebes. He's not banished and he's not blinded. So it's one of those strange things where I set out thinking, how am I going to tell a story that everyone knows the ending to, and then realised not only did everyone not know the ending, but I didn't either. That, in fact, there were so many versions of these stories, and the versions that have survived happen to be the versions which are relatively male-centric. But actually, that very earliest bit in the Odyssey is the bit which is always described in translations as Odysseus, and I quote, meetings with famous women. So in that version, at least, the focus is on her, Calaen Epicastein, beautiful Epicast. And Oedipus is off the... He's not in the scene. You know, he's in the wings, I guess, or behind the scenery. Not that they had scenery, but you know what I mean.
I'm Andy Miller, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
You talk about, you know, again, debating the word original, the Odysseus version, the Odyssey version, and then Sophocles. But I was reading the novel, and not having your classical education, was quite pleased with myself to notice that you'd switched some of the roles around.
I did, and you did notice it. And I have to put this on the record that I saw you before you'd read the afterword, in which I gave some of the things away.
And
you had seen them before you read that.
And then I was disappointed to discover that there is actually just multiple versions, and this is the thing that people do. Those roles are regularly swapped around, not even just necessarily in multiple tellings of the story, but obviously in different settings. That's the thing that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's one of those questions that I didn't really consider until I did the first interview about this book. And the journalist said, you know, so the story has such an inevitability to it. And I thought, no, Sophocles has that. That's all. You're massively underselling his skill. If we say, oh, the story just is, of course it isn't. You know, it's him. That's him who did that. I saw a version of Oedipus a few years ago, somewhere in London, and I can't remember where, but one of those little theatres in Covent Garden, not on the West End. And they did a version of Oedipus, which was the first act, Oedipus the King, the Sophocles version, and the second act, a contemporary version in which Oedipus and Laius, the former king of Thebes, meet at the crossroads, the place where three roads meet, and they have the argument which should culminate in Oedipus killing Laius and, you know, all terrible things ensuing. But instead of that, they work out who each other is. And so what you get instead is this very dialogic, very, you know, almost a two-hander of these two men trying to unpick who they are to each other and why it matters and who's in the right and who's in the wrong. And it was brilliant. But obviously, you could quite legitimately say these people have got the story wrong. They have got the story wrong. You know what happens. He kills him and that's what happens. But it was wonderful. And I suppose there's something, because the story is so solid and because it has that incredible narrative pressure that we know something terrible has happened, we know we've got to get to the end. And it is, you know, watching the or reading Sophocles' version, it's like being, you know, on a freight train. It's like being pulled along millennia before freight trains existed. You're being forced down these tracks that you can't possibly deviate from. But actually there is something, there's a lot more space in the story than Sophocles would have you believe, because that's his gift, is to make it seem inevitable. There's a reason why Aristotle cited it as structurally the greatest tragedy in terms of its sort of, what's the word I want, like plausibility maybe? It isn't the greatest tragedy. Obviously, it's full of coincidences because everything has to happen on the same. The same person has to have been both witness to the killing of Laius and the person who took a baby out of Thebes years earlier. And so it isn't, in terms of its kind of coherence, the most beautiful, but structurally you can't deny it. And so the joy of writing it from the women's perspectives is that Sophocles hadn't, you know, that there was that room there to do it because he had not done it. Ismene has 60 lines in the Antigone, and even Antigone isn't the lead in Antigone. As I say, she has 2/3 the number of lines of her uncle, of Creon. And I had cheerfully got through my whole classical education not ever noticing that, which just goes to show how quick we are to assume that men are, you know, allowed more words than women and don't get to be the lead.
I've been presuming it was Creon, and the fact that his name is actually Creon is hilarious.
Yeah, Creon is fine too, but I always do, yeah, no, I don't know why. Like, I would say Medea too, but not Medea, but yeah.
No, so, but I'm now picturing like
wax crayons. Yeah, perfectly reasonable. Yeah, but yes, you're right. Of course, it is spelled C-R-E-O-N. So,
and to say as well, completely pointlessly now, because we've already been over the point repeatedly. But before I read the book, I was thinking about, oh, what could, you know, you always think about what things you can talk about. And one of the things I was thinking was, oh, great, we can talk about how do you write a story that everybody basically knows what happens.
But it didn't occur to me until surprisingly far through, shamingly far through. I knew what I was going to do with the ending of the Oedipus story. And I thought as I was doing it, you know, but everyone knows this, so I'll have to find a way of sort of disguising it or using a little bit of misdirection so that you're wrong-footed at least, otherwise it won't be as compelling. And then I discovered everyone, in fact, does not know the story of Oedipus. Everyone you know knows the story of Oedipus, but it turns out there are loads of people who studied classics, loads of people who did, you know, a Greek tragedy paper at college, but that was, you know, a while ago and so on, who have forgotten the story or who don't know that it is only one version. And as for the Antigone, almost no one, it seems, knows the plot of the Antigone. I mean, good news for me is that it was a set text for people doing Class Civ this year, so lots of students know it, but generally lots of adults don't. It's just not, although it's performed quite often, it's just not such a well-known play, I guess, and not a byword in the way that, you know, an Oedipal complex is a byword. The Antigone complex isn't a thing. Should be, but it's not. So that story was always much more open to being told differently. But I was a long way through it before I realised that the version that I was actually telling, and I beseech you not to go and Google it because it will just spoil the ending for you, was Euripides' version of Antigone rather than Sophocles, of which only 40 lines survive. So yeah, that's the version of Antigone I told. And I thought as I was doing it for ages, oh, this is going to seem so, you know, radical and everyone's going to be really cross with me for changing the story. And then I thought, oh no, Euripides did it already. Damn it.
And how long is this, the idea of redoing this story, been? How long have you been working on it? How long has this been going around in your mind?
I guess I started writing it, about 3 years ago. Can that be true? A bit less than 3 years ago. Yeah, maybe about 3 years. And I guess I'd been thinking about it for a few months before I started work on it. So, yeah, I suppose Amber came out 3 years ago, and I suppose I was thinking about it then, but I certainly hadn't started writing it at that point, mainly because I was criminally insane from having been judging the Booker forever. And I could barely think about a book, and I got that facial tic, you might remember. But, I suppose it must have been that autumn or something that I started work on it.
We talked about why recast it from the position of the women characters. But also, does that change the meaning in any way? Is there a different reading of the book if it's coming from that perspective, do you think?
I think there absolutely is. I mean, at the most basic level with Jocasta, we are told over and over again about Oedipus that he is smart, that he's clever. We know that because he has won the role of king in a battle of wits. You know, he famously solves the Sphinx's riddle, which is, of course, utterly impossible for anyone to ever solve. No one is going to, you know, be faced with a strange monster that goes, what's got four legs in the morning, two legs in the afternoon, three legs in the evening, and go, it is man, and then walk into it. People would go, even when you know the answer, what, a stick? A stick isn't a leg. What are you talking about, etc.? So he is famously wily. And the play, of course, opens, Sophocles' play opens, with the citizens of Thebes coming to him and saying, look, this plague, what are you going to do about it? And his sort of opening gambit is to say, I've already acted. I've sent my brother-in-law, Creon, away to the Oracle at Delphi to find out what we should be doing. So the very first thing we see of him is that he's faster than his citizens. He's already worked out what the problem is. He's worked it out so much earlier than them. He's already sent his brother-in-law away. His brother-in-law's practically back because the play has unity of time, so it all has to happen in one day. Hurry, hurry. And so it is interesting, therefore, that Jocasta works out the truth of what has happened before Oedipus does in that play, and yet no one ever says she's clever, not once, not one time. So we go, she is pretty canny, this lady. It never happens because she's got such a minor role. She's a supporting role. And so it was enormously tempting, therefore, to take on the role of Jocasta and put her in the centre of a narrative because I knew she'd be clever. And also she has such an interesting attitude to the gods, which seems really anachronistic. And as I was writing, I was thinking, you know, this is going to be reviewed by religious people who'll be furious with me. But she's consistently very sceptical about the gods. Not sceptical, I guess, that they exist, but sceptical that they have any interest in us, any influence mm-hmm. over us. And then only very late in the story, only very late in her story, does she suddenly, what is it, nobody's an atheist in a foxhole, or everybody is, but when things become very, very stressful for her, then she kind of says, you know, she calls on the gods for help. But up to that point, she's been extremely sceptical. And that seemed to me incredibly interesting, this clever, brittle, rational woman that existed, you know, a small role in Sophocles' version. I'm like, well, that can't help but be fun to write, can it? It just can't help it. And Ismenias, the first person narrative, she's such a voice of reason in the Sophoclean version. And in that version, she is the younger sister. But in the Anhui version, the Jean Anhui version from 1943, I'm going to say, but it might be 42, 20th century times are much harder for me to remember than 5th century BCE times. In that version, their birth order is swapped round. So for Anhui, Antigone is the sort of rebel younger sister. But for Sophocles, a girl doing the exact same thing is a pious, dutiful older sister. Mm-hmm. So I like the idea that Ismene and Antigone could, their kind of level of responsibility or rebelliousness could be changed as simply as by saying she's older or she's younger. So that just seemed to me there was so much scope to fill in Ismene that I couldn't resist her.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Natalie Haynes about her latest novel, The Children of Jocasta. And, well, we've talked about the two main characters and the characters that you've changed the focus of the book to sort of concentrate on, Jocasta and Ismene. Tell us about some of the other characters in the book. So you've mentioned Crayon.
Yes.
Who is Jocasta's brother.
Yes.
Ismene's uncle.
Yes.
Who is he?
Well, he is, in the context of this story, I suppose, anachronisms all, please to be excused, he's Stalin. He is this totally controlling king, not in Jocasta's timeline. I don't want to give too much away, but of course, when the terrible revelations of Jocasta and Oedipus' marriage come true, then he is who takes over and becomes king. And he becomes more and more controlling. He should have just a kind of guardianship role for the two brothers, for Polynices and Eteocles. And we certainly get that version in, I'm going to say, The Seven Against Thebes by Aeschylus. But there's also a version by Euripides. Come on, brain. Sorry, haven't got it.
You certainly mentioned The Seven Against Thebes one, which is where it's more a civil war.
It is a full-scale civil war, yeah. And I wanted very much for this novel to feel like a tragedy, i.e. to have just really, not quite, but virtually one set. So it gets more and more claustrophobic as time goes on. So I took that civil war out from seven people storming the Seven Gates of Thebes and brought the whole thing right into the centre, into the Acropolis of Thebes, as it were, the high point of the city, because I really wanted it to have that claustrophobic, tight focus. It was very much something that I wanted the kind of character of the book to be. So Crayon has this, I mean, he certainly likes power, but in theory he is a dutiful brother to Jocasta, and he's a good uncle, he's a good father to his son, and he is trying to bring stability to a city which has been ravaged by plague multiply and also ravaged by civil war. But he becomes, as people often do when they have absolute power, he is damaged and further damaged by it, and his desire to retain that power becomes a distortion of, I think, he is an essentially decent man. And his story runs between the two narratives, the third person and the first person. So he has sort of, we're in his company for longest. And I have long thought that the tragedy, that Sophocles' tragedy, Antigone, is Crayon's tragedy, because he is the one, spoiler, he is the one to whom all terrible damage is done. You know, by the end of the play, almost no one that he loves is left standing. And that moment where the chorus comes and says, you know, I hope you've learned something from this, so too late now, is his. So he is the one who has to live with the sort of terrible consequences of what he's done. And so I hope that this book gives you a way of understanding how an essentially decent, upright man could become so corrupted over time and with power.
And you say he's the person that's on stage for the longest in this retelling, but there's another character that's a thread through both of the narratives and the beginning and the end, which is Sophon.
Yes.
So tell us who he is.
So he is the aged retainer/doctor who Jocasta meets very early on, and of course he is a little nod to Sophocles with his name, which simply means wise in Greek. So he is an archetypally wise old man. He's not old when we meet him, but of course people seemed older, younger, I think, not just because the enormous quantity of dead people in the ancient world means that the average life expectancy was so young. There were quite a lot of old men. Of course, Socrates is 70 when he dies. Sophocles was in his 80s, I think, mid-80s when he dies. But it seemed to me that the role of this older man who could connect Jocasta and her daughter and Ismene by having been present at these sort of crucial episodes in their lives, but equally crucially removed from the power, that he is an advisor, he can never sort of step in and save anyone or do very much. He can only really offer a commentary. So his role is somewhere between informant and chorus, I guess, and so he is just a little way of putting the playwright back in the mix. And Teresa, as I'm sure you noticed, who is the housekeeper when Jocasta first arrives in the royal palace of Thebes, is a little nod to Tiresias, who spends, we're told by him in, I've forgotten which version, is it Hesiod, that he has spent 7 years as a woman. And I thought, well, Teresa will do, I think, is an easier to say name. I wanted the names to be easy to say, because I think I have a terrible tendency when I'm reading Russian books, for example, to just sound basically the first syllable and the last letter in my head. And I do it over and over again. And I think lots of people, when faced with Polynices and Eteocles and names like that, do the same thing. So generally, the siblings are known in Izzy's narrative Ismaili's narrative by a long name, and a Russian narrative, or even German, to be honest. I'm put off by a long name because those aren't languages that I know. So in Ismaili's narrative, she refers to Polynices as Pollen, Eteocles as Etio. So I hope that it makes it a bit less like, oh, not another name. I mean, even with a degree in Greek, which I do technically have, I still find myself watching a play going, right, Polydorus, Polyxena, Polymestor. Seriously, guys? Could we pick a different first sound? So I wanted to make it a bit easier to read, I guess.
And also, so Antigone is Annie, and that yes. also has the function of, well, it sort of disguises them a little bit as well, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, it does a little bit. So I hope it comes as a slight, I hope it comes as a slight surprise, I think. I mean, not from people who are listening to this, obviously, but you should be able to get through a few tens of pages before you realise that the two timelines are running consecutively, rather than, it should take a while before you realise that the connecting tissue is the palace, its place, rather than time.
And I want to move on to Thebes, the place.
Yes.
So this is, it's obviously a Greek city-state.
Yes.
I just presume they were always, like, by the sea.
Yes.
Obviously there was all this, you know,
they
trade going
like
on
they would
and
be,
stuff.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Thebes is this place that's like a good 100 miles inland.
Yes.
And you've got, what's the other place? Not Delphi. Where does Oedipus
Corinth.
Come from? Corinth is the other city-state, which is
he
on the coast.
He is by the sea, yeah.
And one of the things you do, again, one of the things that's, how much we can say about this, really, but one of the sort of modernisations, you mentioned the Riddle of the Sphinx.
Yes.
And you update that story
a
little bit, which I thought was really much more interesting and much more plausible.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I rationalised the Sphinx in the spirit of the rationalists. I made the Sphinx a more rational thing. I have long thought that there's scope for gods and monsters, but I very much wanted this book to be quite a sceptical book, I suppose. So the gods are treated with considerable scepticism by virtually everyone in this book. And the people who believe in them wholeheartedly are generally gullible or dubious, let's say. Not because that's how I personally feel about people who believe in gods, you understand, but because within the context of this story, that's very much how I wanted to tell it. And I did want to demonsterize the story. I wanted it to be a human tragedy, for want of a better phrase, rather than one where a monster could... I mean, the thing is, once you've got a monster who can ask a quizzical set of questions and then chomp you up, then how much tension is there in the rest of the book? Do you know what I mean? Because it could always just come back and eat you. And then you get into that glorious Eddie Izzard territory of Tales of the Unexpected, where a man opens a door and a pig eats him, because no one can write in and say, I totally expected the pig eating him incident. And so I very much didn't want it to be the case that a man could open a door and a pig could eat him, and that's why the Sphinx got changed.
And the other thing that's sort of overlaying the entire story and continuously comes back and plays the role, obviously brings back the idea of the people that are the ones that believe in the fates and the gods, is that there's this plague that's threatening all the time.
Yes. And that, I mean, I think that is very, it's very difficult, isn't it, thinking about plague in terms of what it must have been like before you knew what it was. And if I had to say what my kind of foundational text was for it, in terms of the symptoms, it's Thucydides. Thucydides, a historian, 5th century Greek, 5th century Athenian, who lives through the Great Plague of Athens, which strikes at the very start of the Peloponnesian War in 431, 430, and writes Pericles' great funeral oration in, I think it's book 265, I think, in which he addresses the people of Athens on the occasion of them burying their collective war and plague dead. He himself, Pericles, would shortly die of plague, unfortunately. And Thucydides had the plague and recovered from it. And so he can detail the symptoms quite specifically, almost all of which I purloined wholesale for this plague in Thebes. So it's out by 700 years and a couple of hundred miles, but it is an ancient plague told by one of its survivors. But the sort of the sense of terrible, crushing fear, and also of a sense that the fates might have it in for you, or the gods might have it in for you, but that you wouldn't know until it was too late, is, I think, almost entirely stolen from Mark Ravenhill's opera. Is that the word I want? Or musical, I guess, or with Mark Almond, which was called, I think, Ten Plagues, was unbelievably moving. I remember seeing it in Edinburgh a few years ago, and was unbelievably moving, this sort of terrible sense of, you know, death stalking the streets and just people not knowing what was going to become of them. And so I very much wanted that sense of crushing fear and a sense that you needed to hide, but you didn't know where to hide or what you were hiding from.
I'm Charlotte Higgins, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So, yeah, sticking with Thebes.
Yes.
As you mentioned earlier in the interview, that you wanted the setting of this, the claustrophobic atmosphere of the story to be sort of contained further and further as the characters become more and more imprisoned in smaller and smaller parts of the palace. Tell us something about that palace, researching what that palace would have been like.
Well, the palace is partly stolen from Crete, I'm afraid. The remains that exist at Thebes are not particularly well preserved. There's not very many of them. There is a museum in Thebes which has just reopened, I think, or in the last 6 months or so reopened, but had been closed for 7 years because, you know, Greek financial woes have been sufficient that it closed for a refurb and then they couldn't get the money together to reopen it, I think. And so this Thebes is a sort of combination of Crete and Knossos particularly. But if you look at artist recreations of Knossos, it has multiple floors. I mean, the Greeks are much more architecturally sophisticated, even at this period, which is sort of the 12th, 13th century BCE, the Bronze Age, the Heroic Age. And I very much wanted it to have a slightly more stage set feel. So it's on one floor. I've reduced it down. And I was like, well, I could add in some stairs. And I just can't keep it all in my head. it's a treble courtyard. There's a big public courtyard, a big public space. And then a sort of like a professional courtyard. The second courtyard is where, you know, kingly ruling business takes place, or in Jocasta's case, queenly ruling business takes place. And then at the back, there is this private courtyard that just belongs to the family. And where that is where Izzy is supposed to be. And that is, again, it's a sign that this book is sort of operating in between the time in which it's set and the time in which Sophocles is writing. Because, of course, in the time in which it's set, women, you know, royal women like Medea can go off and do whatever the hell they like, for the most part. And in the time in which he is writing, Athenian women can do literally nothing. They're cloistered. You know, they're stuck behind high walls all day, every day. And it sounds like an incredibly boring existence. So poor Ismene is caught in between these two worlds. You know, she's had a life of incredible privilege in which, you know, obviously she doesn't have to go and, you know, make shoes or sew things or weave or spin, which lots of women would have had to have done. But the flip side is that her world gets smaller and smaller as the book goes on. So her existence becomes more and more claustrophobic. And so I hope it has a sort of mixed heritage of being a real palace and a stage set version of one.
Just one more thing from me then, and then we'll get you to read a little bit. What's next?
Troy is next. The women of Troy come next for me. So, yes, I have to finish being on the road for this book. I've been on the road for a couple of months. I've got a couple more months to go talking about it and talking about Greek tragedy and in particular the sort of foundational myths of Thebes and things, which is joyous for me. But yeah, I think July probably is when I'll get back to the Trojan women.
Right, if you would kindly read us a little bit.
I will read you a little bit. I will read it from the very start, because I'm extremely small-c conservative when it comes to reading, and I always worry if... should I tell you what the dedication is? I normally do this on your programme, don't I? I dedicate all my books to Dan, because he is a saintly saint, a secular saint is what he is, and without him, etc., etc. And I always pick a bit, or recently I've picked a bit from Antigone, which is quite difficult, because it's not a very romantic play. So for Amber, I stole a bit of Antigone, which was directed as an insult, and I repurposed it, and I've done the exact same thing here. In fact, it's from only a few lines after that quote. So this is an argument between Creon and his son Hymon, and in fury Creon says, as Hymon defends Antigone's position, he says, "Hogun logos soi pas super kenes hore." Every word you say is on behalf of that woman. So I thought I would go with that, because he is a staunch defender, as all good partners should be, of course, irrespective of sex. I will read you from Izzy, if that's all right, because she's more fun for me to read by virtue of the fact that she is in the first person. And the book begins with her reading a parchment scroll in a sort of dark corner of the courtyard. I should tell you that this is before alphabetic writing, so she must be reading in either Linear A or Linear B. But her great-great-great-great-great-grandfather Cadmus was the mythical inventor of the alphabet, so I'm afraid I couldn't resist having her reading. But at some point someone will write in and go, "I think you'll find." And then I will have the restraint not to write back and go, "Well, I think you'll find. It's an adorable and hilarious joke," because it won't be an adorable and hilarious joke, and they will just steal my lunch money. So she has been reading, and then she is disturbed by the presence of a stranger. "We were the exact same height, so our eyes met for a moment. His were a watery sort of grey with two brown specks in the right iris. It made it look like a bird's egg. I should keep running into the courtyard, I thought, and then out the other side, through to the next square where my brothers and my uncle would be. I could return the manuscript to Sophon and apologise for taking it without asking. He wouldn't mind.
But even as I was thinking this, it occurred to me that perhaps my legs wouldn't carry me as far as the second courtyard. I was standing in the beating sun, but I was cold. The man looked past me for a second, though there was no one behind me. Then his eyes met mine. Wordless, he turned and walked away. I thought perhaps I might sit on the ground. I took a few more steps and fell to my knees just before I was fully in the courtyard. A girl I didn't recognise, the daughter of one of the house slaves, I suppose, was coming out of a bedroom, carrying a tray. The noise of me falling, my thick silver bangle crashing onto the ground, made her turn and she screamed, dropping what she was carrying everywhere. Hollow wooden things, cups maybe, or bowls. I heard them bounce and crash across the warm grey slabs. I hissed at her to be quiet, but she was too far away. And besides, she was making so much noise herself, she wouldn't have heard anything I said. The light was so bright, it made me want to close my eyes. I saw the shadows of birds flying across the square, but I couldn't raise my head to see the birds themselves. After a long time, or perhaps no time at all, I heard voices, but they all sounded strange, distorted, as though I were hearing them underwater. I blinked, but my eyes wouldn't quite focus. There were guards and servants and then my brothers, everyone running towards me. They were shouting, I could see from their flushed faces, but I could barely make out what they were saying. It sounded like, "They've killed her." Killed who? There was only one person left in my family that could possibly mean. My sister Annie. "Please don't let it be Annie," I thought. "However much we argue, I can't lose her too, please." The last thing I remembered was looking down to see that Sofon's manuscript was completely ruined, covered in something sticky and red. I would have to apologise. It would be hard to replace. And then, of course, I realised they meant me. Someone had killed me.
I've been talking to Natalie Haynes. We've been talking about her latest novel, The Children of Jocasta, which is out now from Mantle. Natalie, thank you so much for coming in and
sharing
it with us.
Thanks for having me. It's an important part of publication coming in to talk to you about it. We have to never stop.
Never stop.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Some people take the straight path in life, but at Arizona State University, we respect your twists and turns. They make our online students more driven to excel in their professional lives. That's why our personalized suite of services empowers you with innovative resources and staff that sticks with you. Make your next turn with one of our 300-plus programs at ASU, number one in innovation for 9 consecutive years. Visit us at asuonline.asu.edu to learn more.